Hello, listeners. You're listening to FlixWise Canada, and today I'm joined by a pair of perfect guests, umbrella-twirling film writer and comic book enthusiast John Arminio. Hi, John.
Hey, Martin. It's great to finally be podcasting with you.
Great to have you on. And also joining us is clad in head-to-toe vinyl film writer Alexandria Daniels. Hi, Alexandria.
Hi, Martin.
I'm glad to have you both here to talk about the Tim Burton Batman movies. We're going to talk about Batman 89 and its sequel, Batman Returns. I'm sure some other Batman and comic book stuff will make its way into the conversation, but that's going to be the main focus. So I'm curious how everyone was first introduced to these. For me, I'm a late 80s baby, so like this was kind of just the Batman thing that was around, and that was sort of my big introduction to Batman. If I've seen the 1989 film 100 times, I've probably seen Batman Returns 1,000 times, but that's where I'm coming from with these. So, John, how were you first introduced to the Tim Burton Batman movies?
I came to the Tim Burton Batman movies late because I was born in 84, so I think I was just too young to see it in the theaters, and it just kind of like passed me by, so I had to come to it like in college, and it took me a long time to sort of come around to Batman Returns. I love it now, but I think it put me off a little bit for a while, but I sort of came around to its weirdness and its eccentricities.
Oh, for sure. I'm always a little bit surprised, or maybe I'm not really surprised, but when I found out that a lot of comic book fans aren't particularly fond of these movies, it seems to, I don't know, in my experience, it's kind of come up a lot where there's a little bit of a schism from, you know, or maybe some comic book fans liked it at the time and don't like them as much, or some kind of came around to them. So that's one thing I sort of noticed just in preparing to talk about them.
Well, I think because it was such a cultural phenomenon in 89 that comic book readers who really sort of hold on to their version of Batman as, you know, the sacred and true Batman, they saw hundreds of millions of people around the world see that this to be the real Batman, and they sort of kind of took that a little harshly and couldn't see the strengths of the movie for themselves, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And Alexandra, how were you first introduced to these films?
Well, I'm a 90s baby. I was kind of introduced to both this movie and Batman Forever.
Right.
I almost at the same time. Like, my family loves Batman, and I'm the only one that really loves Marvel. And my brother's like, you should check out Batman because he's just as great or probably even better. And I'm like, okay, fine. So I would always watch Tim Burton's Batman the most, and it just really grew on me. Mm-hmm. This was like before I began to really just look up to Burton as a film director. So I was already kind of used to just seeing just Batman like on the fly. Like, I just loved watching this movie. I knew nothing about Batman Returns, though. I would see images of like the Penguin, but I was like, oh, this is very different from what I'm already used to. And then of course Batman Forever came along, and that became one of my favorites too. I have no shame in admitting that. I love that movie just as much. But now that I've gotten used to watching a lot of Tim Burton movies, I began to kind of appreciate the first Batman movie and how influential that movie was. And even despite of all the other films he's made, it seems like almost like the least Tim Burton movie out of everything he's done, but it still has his signature on it. So
for me, it was also sort of a big introduction to Tim Burton as a filmmaker. And it's really strange now, like in my mind, Batman and Batman Returns always kind of went hand in hand. But looking back at them now, it's sort of clear that one is way more Tim Burton-y than the other. I think it's sort of amazing, actually, how much Batman Returns feels more like a Tim Burton film, even though obviously the first one, he put his stamp on it. And I think like it's the Tim Burton touch that really makes that first Batman movie.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that always kind of surprises me about Tim Burton is how he had the ability, especially I think like in the 90s when he was firing on all thrusters, to work within these big studio projects and still make it feel idiosyncratic and personal. And I think like for me, Batman Returns, it fits right alongside Edward Scissorhands and Ed Wood, and it doesn't feel hampered by being a big summer blockbuster. It actually feels really unusual for a big summer release. And I love the film as a kid, but looking back at it now, like I still love it obviously, but it's like, oh my god, I can't believe I liked some of this stuff as a kid. It's so grotesque and so dark.
Yeah, when I was rewatching it, I was like, okay, the first time I watched it, I kind of shook my head. I love Tim Burton, but I'm like, how much creative control did they give you, Burton? Like,
all of it.
Yeah. Oh my god, yeah. All of it. And it's like, I don't want to say I hate it, because I don't really hate the movie. It is entertaining. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you've seen Edward Scissorhands, you can't help but kind of enjoy Batman Returns. And if you love Beetlejuice, you're really going to love this, because it's ghoulish and it's playful. But it deviates from the first movie.
I think in the context of what Batman Returns is as a sequel to one of the biggest movies ever, I think it's the weirdest Tim Burton movie. Like, if you hear Tim Burton is making a biopic about Ed Wood, you kind of know it's going to be weird and quirky and idiosyncratic. But a Tim Burton Batman movie you think is going to try and be, you know, like a four-quadrant seed for various marketing initiatives and toy lines, but Batman Returns is a straight up nightmare.
Yes.
The character with the most screen time is a sexual predator who oozes black bile from his mouth. Like, it's crazy.
I mean, that's kind of what got Tim Burton off of doing a third Batman movie. There's an anecdote where he talked about going in to kind of pitch his idea for a third one, and Two-Face and Robin and all that stuff, and he said sort of half an hour to the meeting, realized that they were like, don't you want to go and do a smaller film? And he sort of realized they didn't want him to come back and make a third one. I think financially it did pretty well, not as well as the first one, but it was more the complaints from the merchandising that I think put pressure on the studio to make the Schumacher films and make them more family-friendly, more child-oriented. And, you know, the tone of those ones, it's like a complete 180. Those are more like big budget attempts at trying to imitate the tone of the television show.
Yeah.
But, you know, they said, like, McDonald's, you're supposed to make Happy Meal figures for Batman Returns. What can you do with a character like Penguin, or, you know, somebody as sexually overt as the Catwoman character? And I think all that pressure kind of made them not want to do a third one with Tim Burton. But, you know, because, like you said, the first one made so much money and it was such a big hit, they just wanted Tim Burton back basically at any cost. And the only way he was going to do that is if they gave him full creative control, and he really used it. Like, that's sort of the amazing thing, too. When you look at all the superhero films that have come out since, you go back and watch Batman Returns, and it's like number one in the hierarchy of what it is. It's a Tim Burton film. And number two, it's a Batman film. You know, so it's very unusual to see this auteurist project that's tied to a big superhero franchise.
Yeah, and he's using Batman in the way that, like, Alan Moore used Batman in The Killing Joke as a cipher to tell these stories of these other characters, because you don't get nearly as much insight into the psychological underpinnings of what motivates Bruce Wayne as you do certainly with the Penguin, and even more towards Joker. And that's certainly not the case with the Nolan films, and it looks like the Matt Reeves movie is going to be a very, you know, Bruce Wayne, Batman-focused movie. And so I think a lot of comic book writers use that viewpoint on the Batman character as he's just this, you know, sort of shadow in the night who fights crime, and it's the rogues gallery that formulates the story. Whereas a writer like Tom King, who just ended his run on Batman last year, was much more focused on the Batman Bruce Wayne character who drives the story.
Right. I think that was one of the complaints that was pretty consistent about Batman Returns, that Batman's not really in that much of the movie, and the focus is more on these villain characters. Although I don't think that's an issue for me when I watch the film, because it's Batman's story being told through these other characters, and they're all reflections of him in a way. For me, one thing that's surprising about these films is, even though they're very ridiculous in some ways and outlandish, there's a psychological nuance to a lot of these characters that's very interesting to me. And I think examining these characters who are broken but refuse to be victimized and create these personas, and it's empowering for them, but it also comes at the cost of them being able to overcome their own trauma. It's really interesting in how it approaches the psychology of these characters.
I also want to add that as ridiculous looking Batman Returns is, Tim Burton has always been a bit personal in his work. And I was thinking about Edward Scissorhands throughout most of the movie, because there were some shots in there, especially around like the abandoned zoo. And you hear the music that Danny Elfman, he switches up the theme of the Batman thing quite a bit. he adds more strings and he has the usual choir that you don't really hear in Tim Burton movies. It does add the fairy tale aspect, but it does play along with this theme of the other, because yes. Tim Burton has always felt like he was the outsider. He grew up in Burbank. He was that weird kid that loved comic books and he loved to draw real things. He loved horror and he always felt like on the outside. And here he's creating an adaptation of Batman, which also talks about being other, about being the outsider. And he has like the Penguin, who's definitely seen as this outside creature. And I just find it really interesting. He still puts his own personal touches into these characters.
Yeah.
I mean, really, there's four main characters in Batman Returns. There's Batman, Penguin, Catwoman, and there's Max Schreck, who's played by Christopher Walken. And Max Schreck is the only one who's not an outsider. And it's interesting that, like, he's probably the one that has the most in common with the Bruce Wayne character. He's rich, but, you know, he uses his wealth to accumulate power, and he's sort of the evil or negative version of that character. And it's interesting that even though on the outside Bruce Wayne more resembles Max Schreck, like on the inside he belongs with these outsiders like Penguin and Catwoman, even though he's in conflict with them. And I think how you can make a character like Batman relatable in a way, like, I think part of it's that the casting of Michael Keaton is in some ways not what you'd expect. I know when they were first making the film, a lot of people expected them to cast sort of the square-jawed typical kind of action hero type character, and you hear a lot of the names of people who were thrown around when they were casting the film, people like Mel Gibson, or, you know, like action hero types, leading man types. And not that Michael Keaton's not a movie star, but like he's sort of an unlikely leading man for a superhero film. And like I love the take on Batman of Bruce Wayne as somebody who wears glasses and has a receding hairline and spends his nights sitting in front of a computer screen, or just, you know, with his head on his hand, lost in thought. You really believe that this character doesn't fit in, and there's something strange about him that can't fit into society in a normal way, and you understand completely where this Batman persona comes from.
Tim Burton said that he wanted to cast somebody who looked like he needed to put on a bat suit for effect. Like, he needed somebody who needed an extra ingredient to be frightening. And I think, yeah, if you wouldn't be scared to find Michael Keaton in a dark alley, but maybe Michael Keaton in a costume with a batarang, that might be a little more frightening.
Right.
I can understand why certain like comic book fans were concerned or at least skeptical, like why Michael Keaton was going to be cast in this film, because I know, you know, after seeing Beetlejuice, you're wondering, oh goodness, like where's this going to go? You know, like you already had like they had the Adam West version of Batman, and of course people were afraid, oh, it's going to be another campy version. But I liked when Tim Burton brought up how he looked at Keaton and he sees in his eyes, like he seemed on the surface level, like he seems like a really cool, charming man. But then if you look into his eyes, it makes you wonder what is going on in his head. And you see that in the film when he's like looking at the screens in the Batcave, and when he is just observing the Joker, like he's, you see a twinge in his eyes, like he can understand the torment of Bruce Wayne. He was able to bring that forth into the screen, but I could definitely get why people would not trust that in the beginning.
There's a lot of shots of just Bruce Wayne staring into a fire in both movies, and I think maybe you can suss out a symbol for what those shots are supposed to mean, but really I think it's purely aesthetic. Tim Burton just loves Michael Keaton's face and the look of the flames reflected in Michael Keaton's eyes, and it's a great image to sort of be a visual contrast to the sort of like gray and black iconography of the Gotham skyline.
I think my copy of the first Batman film was taped off of television I got from someone, and it was missing the very first scene. It started right after that, so I never saw until I was a little bit older the I'm Batman line.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
When he's on the rooftop, and famously that's an ad lib where like his line was supposed to be something like I'm the knight, but Keaton just said I'm Batman. And I always kind of wondered if that was his way of calming people down who were skeptical of his casting, that like, no, like right from the first scene he's Batman and you can't argue with that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful line that's sort of lived on in Batman lore like since then, and in the lore of Michael Keaton's career. Like, I don't think he can ever get away from that moment, and in some ways the character can't get away from that moment either.
I agree. I think it's also his moment of him realizing, oh, I'm playing this major character and this is going to be an experience.
And it's sort of funny, like his performance changes a little bit from one film to the next. I noticed too, it's a little bit more subdued, I think, in the second film. You have moments in the first one where it feels like they want to show this ferocity, and you have that scene with the Joker where he's not in costume, but he grabs the fire poker and says, "You want to get nuts? Let's get nuts." And there's nothing really like that in the second film, where it feels a little bit more reserved and more mannered. But I think they were trying to show Batman as somebody who could be dangerous and aggressive, and try to break that Adam West image that a lot of people had going into it. Although it's sort of funny now that, like, at the time when it came out, people were like, "Oh, this is nothing like the Adam West show. This is serious Batman. We can take this seriously." But there's a lot of goofy stuff still in the movie, and it's quite outrageous at times and playful. Like, one of my favorite sequences of the first film is the whole art gallery piece.
Yes, I love it.
In some ways, like, that's kind of something you'd expect Joker to do in the 1960s Batman show. I think that maybe even is something he did, where he was like painting over famous works of
Yeah,
art.
I think it is actually, yeah.
And you have that great moment where Jack Nicholson's Joker stops them from ruining the Francis Bacon figure with meat, saying, "I kind of like this one." But that's a funny sequence, and there's a lot in the film that's funny and playful. And I think now that you have these attempts to make Batman a character that exists in something resembling the real world, it sort of stands out to me more now how fun these movies are, I think.
Maybe just because I've immersed my soul and being into comic books for a little too long. The idea that Batman from 1966 to 89 was this goof that nobody took seriously, I kind of like pushed back against because, in the 70s, you had Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams take the Batman character, very seriously. You had characters like Ra's al Ghul appear in 1971, and so there's been this dark tone, up until and through the 80s, especially with Dark Knight Returns in 86. And so I think the comic book world was already immersed in a quote unquote serious Batman. There was this perception from people who just didn't read comics that they all they had knew was Adam West. And I think that's unfortunate because I love that version of Batman.
Yes.
I don't think there's any reason we need to soundly reject it. It's just that it has its place in its time, just like the Batman 89 and Batman Returns have its own place in its own time.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably easier for people to accept the Adam West kind of take on Batman now that the Christopher Nolan stuff exists, and now that there's Ben Affleck Batman, there's another Batman on the way. You have enough options that you can kind of go back and appreciate the sense of humor and the intelligence of that take on Batman. But I think how the Tim Burton films distinguish themselves from the Adam West show, it's not so much in content, but like you said, the tone and aesthetically, it kind of takes it to this whole unexpected place that
Yeah.
I think it even impacted the comic books, and I know it definitely impacted the animated series, the timeless qualities that Tim Burton mixed into it. Like, what's funny is trying to define what kind of a time period these movies are set in. Obviously, it's like 1940s or something like
Yeah.
that.
Tim Burton has always been sort of been obsessed with German Expressionism. He's put imagery from the Academy of Dr. Caligari in like all of his movies. So anytime you see a rotund man in a top hat, that's Dr. Caligari. The Somnambulist is basically Edward Scissorhands. But I'm fascinated by the fact that there's this sort of collision in Batman Returns of German Expressionism with like fascist architecture, which killed German Expressionism. So
Yes.
there's all this unfathomably large looming skyscrapers supported by columns made out of supermen naked and bursting with muscles. So it's just this sort of wonderfully incongruous image that plays throughout both films and is sort of in keeping with the anachronistic tone or the anachronistic technology in both of them.
So I definitely appreciate the German Expressionism influences in the first film because they were easily noticeable. They use like Fritz Lang's Metropolis as an influence to make Gotham City look like it was more than just a replication of New York City, but something that was more devious and much more dark. And it does translate, but what I noticed in Batman Returns, some of those influences were still there. But what kind of got me was that Burton kind of brought his childlike, ghoulish side of him for like some of the characters' designs, particularly for the Penguin, I've noticed. Like, he did not go by the traditional comic strip. A guy in a top hat with a monocle, he looks pretty normal. And Tim Burton goes like, no, we're not doing this today. He actually made his own rough sketch and made him more take on the persona of a penguin and made him really cartoonish. And it does clash with the expressionist part, but at the same time, it's true to his nightmarish style. It somehow works, but somehow it kind of rubs me the wrong way.
I think that sketch, like, it's such a loose, cartoony kind of sketch, but it also looks just like Danny DeVito in the film.
Yeah, but it also looks like, if you've seen his short film Vincent, then you're used to that type of style. He's always drawn from Victorian Gothic influences.
Yeah.
And for Batman, he leaned more towards German Expressionism, maybe a little bit of film noir and art decor to give Gotham a much more distinct look. But his bottom line is always something mischievous. And I love that, though. I love that.
Yeah, Penguin's almost like a Charles Adams cartoon come to life. Or...
he has like a Victorian kind of outfit almost. But to me, what it made me think of, not so much like the Nosferatu character is very lanky, but that kind of makeup where the features are distorted in this way, and you know, he's got that long nose the way like Nosferatu's got these long ears. Like, it's not a one-for-one kind of replica, but it makes me think a lot of that. And of course, Max Schreck, the character's name directly after the actor who played Nosferatu. To me, Penguin's like that kind of a monster a little bit. And I was thinking, like, this is something that on one hand I wouldn't say like offends me, but it definitely raises a question mark in my head how the Penguin seems to be this sort of Semitic stereotype. I mean, the whole backstory for him being left by his parents, like in a basket floating down into the sewers, it's like Moses being put in the basket, and then his like plan to kill all the firstborn children of Gotham at the end is very Moses. And like, it makes me think a little bit of, again, something like Nosferatu, where it's obviously like a Slavic stereotype, and it's playing on those kinds of fears in people. And I don't know, I think like it's in some ways translated into what Batman Returns is doing, and it's something that I think could make people uncomfortable. And, you know, I mean, everything about the characters seems designed to make people uncomfortable, but you know what I mean? Like, it's something that I do kind of question or think about when I watch the film now.
It is interesting because his parents certainly don't seem Jewish. They seem very, like, the epitome of WASP. But the Moses corollaries are very obvious, and there's the whole thing with Tim Burton basically celebrating the outsider. Mm-hmm. So it's a morass of contradictory images, and I don't know really how to take all that in.
Sorry, I just want to add, and maybe this is just my observation. I no one mentioned like the Hunchback of Notre Dame or anything, but I find it's really interesting that he has like a Moses backstory, but he comes off like a Quasimodo type of character without the sympathy too much, because he's obviously, he becomes more psychotic. But it's just like his parents, in the story of Moses, his parents didn't get rid of him because he was ugly. This the guy wanted to get him away from the conflict of him from being killed. In this story, they put him in a basket because he was ugly and tried to get him away. And I found like that sounds like a Quasimodo-ish type of story. And it's like, I sometimes like question, was there a little bit of influence from Hunchback of Notre Dame? If not, then that's just something that I just noticed from that. It's just like a huge clash of various influences. Yeah.
That's a really good point. I think I do find him sympathetic in a weird way. Like, obviously he's completely monstrous, not just in his appearance, but how he acts. But you understand why he acts that way. It's because he's constantly being rejected for the way he looks, and, you know, rejected by his parents, and his sort of sexual advances on Catwoman, and when she rejects him, he tries to kill her, and you sort of get the sense that, like, him lashing out at the end, it's because this whole town rejected him, and he just wants to lash out violently. So his monstrous actions and his behavior, even though it's completely disturbing, I feel like there's at least an understanding why he is the way he is. And I don't know about both of you, I feel awful when he dies at the end. Like, you just feel like... it's this totally tragic thing, and it's one of those things that's also ridiculous, where you have the little procession of penguins the funeral march of the Penguins. But I still feel sad when he dies, because it feels like just some kind of failing, like the world failed this character and turned him into a monster. And, you know, some, you have characters in film and literature who are deformed, but who are, you know, almost saint-like, like Merrick and the Elephant Man, which the film deliberately alludes to, but it plays on, where, you know, the Penguin, he's saying, I'm not a man, I'm an animal. It's like he's deliberately not trying to fit in and not trying to be accepted because he's being rejected. And it's just a strange dichotomy, like you said, but it definitely stands out in my mind as an interesting character. Just thinking more like some of the other film references, like you mentioned some of the Art Deco stuff and the film noir stuff in the first one. One film I noticed a lot of visual allusions to is Citizen Kane. And, like, of course, Burton referenced Orson Welles sort of explicitly in Ed Wood, but, like, the table gag I noticed when Vicki Vale first goes over to have dinner with Bruce Wayne, and they're at this giant table where they're talking and they can hardly hear each other. They're so far away. Like, that's right out of Citizen Kane. And just some of the shots, like, when you first are introduced to Harvey Dent, played by Billy Dee Williams, it's shot just like Citizen Kane's rally, or his big speech where he's got this portrait behind him. And that made me sort of think, like, if they had made a third Tim Burton Batman movie with Billy Dee Williams, it would have been almost like the, you know, a sort of Citizen Kane kind of arc to him, where it's the good man who eventually, like, somehow becomes corrupted and bad. And it made me sort of think, like, maybe they were already planning in advance what to do with that character, but
I read originally, yeah, in the draft for Batman Returns, they originally had Harvey Dent in there, but then they took him out and swapped him with Max Schreck.
Right.
So I'm like, oh, I kind of wish you kind of stuck with the Harvey Dent. That would have been interesting to see a two-faced character. It was a scene where the Catwoman, Selina Kyle, kills Max Schreck at the end with the taser, and it was supposed to be Harvey Dent in that scene, but they eventually cut him out.
It seems like a lot of ideas kind of got suggested and then thrown out, and you know, like, at one point they were gonna see if they could work Robin into it, and they're like, ah, next movie. So no.
One thing about the table gag in Citizen Kane, I think, you know, Tim Burton is deliberately using Citizen Kane as sort of an antithetical model for Bruce Wayne, because once Bruce Wayne realizes the ridiculousness of the situation, they go downstairs and they have, like, a very everyday meal with Alfred.
Yeah.
You know, so the upstairs, you know, Lord of the Manor goes downstairs and you know, enjoys the everyday exchange of, you know, food and conversation with another actual human being. And so I thought that was, you know, one of the very key character development moments in the Batman 89.
Exactly. And of course, like, there's other parallels you could draw to Kane's parents aren't killed, but he's separated from them, and you know, there's a couple of connections like that. And of course, I thought it was sort of funny too, because Orson Welles voiced the Shadow on the radio show, and some people always say that the Batman character was basically a riff or ripoff of the Shadow. So in some ways, it feels like very appropriate to kind of homage Orson Welles in the film.
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
I was wondering what you both think about the Vicki Vale character.
She's definitely no Selina Kyle, but I do like her, okay? I'll put it like that. I understand that, like, she's kind of seen as, like, the damsel, but I don't really see that as a negative, because I liked her chemistry with Michael Keaton, Kim Basinger playing Vicki Vale. I thought their chemistry was just organic, and she brought a softness to Bruce Wayne and to Batman. There's a scene in the film, in the first Batman movie, where she's in the Batcave, which is not supposed to. She's talking to Batman. Batman's looking at the screens and talking about the Joker and referencing about, you know, the chemicals that he uses to try to poison all the people. And he mentioned, like, how he's a freak. And she kind of turns to him and goes, well, you're kind of the same way. You know, that's what other people say about you. And he turns to her and goes, what people are looking at me the same way? Like, and she can kind of bring him almost, like, back to earth a little bit. She kind of balances him out, and I like that from her.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, I like Basinger in the role, but I think Vicki Vale is almost written to be, like, half of a Lois Lane, because Lois Lane is, like, Vicki Vale and Knox put together. Yeah, this very independent, beautiful reporter, but who's also like very eccentric and obsessed with being a reporter, you know, especially the way like certain writers have written her in her solo series in the comics, or the way Margot Kidder played her in the Superman movies. But here she kind of, Vicky Vale sort of gets Knox to do all the hard work. Like, go investigate what's weird about that corner Bruce Wayne and Nick visits every year. And so then he comes back with all the research that he's done. And she's like, oh, well, thanks for doing my reporting job for me. But Kim Basinger is great in the role, and it is great to see her on screen with Michael Keaton.
I like her performance. Like, I think my issues with the character have more to do with not even so much like how she's written, but like the function that she's designed to serve in the story. I think like partly as an audience surrogate, I think it feels a little bit unnecessary. And I get why a studio making a big, expensive Batman movie at that time would have been nervous and say like, oh, you kind of need a character to bring audiences into this world, which is bizarre. You want this character to kind of lead you into the world of Batman. But I always think it's kind of unnecessary because from the first shot, it's like, oh yeah, this is a world where Batman can exist. You just get it completely. And I think probably like at the script level, you know, studio and producers might not have seen that. So like I say, well, you put this character in the script to kind of work that out. And I think that kind of drags some of the momentum of the film for a little bit. And also, it always seems like weird to me, Joker and Batman kind of fighting over her, like Joker just immediately becoming obsessed with her. Although like Basinger, she plays the scenes very well. Like I love her little interaction with Jack Nicholson.
You must be joking.
Do I look like I'm joking?
No. Jack Nicholson has that completely deadpan, do I look like somebody who's joking? Well, he also has this like horrific formed kind of smile, ghoulish smile that's like grafted onto his face. And it's such a deadpan funny moment that I think it works really well. Like, and also, you know, having somebody, like you said, who is there partly to soften the Batman character and bring some humanity. Like, I prefer, I think, in Batman Returns, where Batman is almost that human anchor for even stranger characters. And to me, the romance is sort of a love-hate connection with the Catwoman character, Selina Kyle. Like, I prefer the way that works, where it feels like, oh yeah, this is the only character who could really sort of understand who Batman is on that level, but she's just like an inch and a half further over that abyss than he is, and he's trying to save her, and she, you know, maybe she's somebody who can't be saved. And I think that dichotomy, I just kind of prefer that and find it more interesting. And I always get really kind of more emotionally caught up in that relationship, and you know, when they find out that, oh, Bruce Wayne is Batman and Selina Kyle is Catwoman at the same time, and you know, she asks,
does this mean we have to start fighting?
How conflicted these characters are, where they have more in common with each other than anyone else, but they also can't really be together in the long run. Like I always found that relationship very interesting, and that's played up a lot in the comic books. Not to compare these too much to the Christopher Nolan films, but I always thought it was like silly that Batman and Catwoman would end up together and like go off and get married in France or something like that. Like I never understood that. No, like to me it's like a really great kind of relationship that should never have a happy ending. Like
I agree.
I'll give myself up on one condition.
What's that?
We run away to Europe together, sip tea in a cafe, and live happily ever after.
Holy unsatisfying ending.
They have good chemistry, they do, but it's, you could tell they can't be in a relationship because they're way too similar. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like about Vicky Vale. She kind of gives him the possibility of having that relationship because she kind of lets Bruce Wayne or Batman be a bit vulnerable. At least she tries to kind of give him that space. And that's what I really appreciate about Vicky Vale. And that's why I say sometimes it worked for me because he already has that tension of having this duality he's trying to maintain. But she mm-hmm. was trying to give him a chance to just open up. And I like that. It kind of freed him up a little bit. But I do like Selina Kyle in that she meets Bruce Wayne and Batman on that level. And so she understands the torment. She understands the psyche. And it makes it an interesting combo to see on screen. But I just knew in the end, like, they can't be together.
Yeah. It's funny, like, just to see, like, how different the first and second one, Batman 89 and Batman Returns, to see how different they are, all you have to do is watch the last shot. Like, that makes it so clear. Where, you know, the first one, Joker's dead, he saved the girl, the camera pans up and it's this triumphant music, and it's, you know, wow, it's a superhero movie. And the second one's a tragedy, like, maybe save the city, but he couldn't save Catwoman, and he's at the end lonely and depressed, and it's this very melancholic note that the movie ends on, even though they have the little stinger with the Catwoman's head kind of rising up to the Bat signal, which apparently was like a last minute kind of addition to the movie because they wanted to have the Catwoman spinoff, which that was one of those films that kind of stayed in limbo for a long time. I know there were like several attempts to make like a Michelle Pfeiffer Catwoman spinoff movie. I think Where She Goes to a City Almost Like Las Vegas, the way that Gotham's like New York, and that sounded really cool. And then there was like several attempts to make it. I think the screenwriter Big Fish, he did a version of it. He was sort of tweeting last year, like, his pitch, which got turned down for a Catwoman movie, and like, make it more like Matrix, can you put a scene in where Catwoman washes somebody's hair, and then like, oh, can we get Michelle Geller to do it? And I think it's like, it gradually kind of evolved, and like, it changed after the Schumacher films came out, and one of those movies that just stayed in development hell until it finally turned into the Halle Berry Catwoman film.
It makes me sad because Catwoman is such a rich and deep and interesting character. Like, in the early 2000s, there was a comic storyline that was very film noir influenced, called Trail of the Catwoman. It was by Ed Brubaker and Darwin Cook, and it was very much a, you know, a noir heist on a train sort of film put to comics. And something like that, I think, would be a fantastic movie. But, you know, instead we got the Halle Berry Sharon Stone thing, like, probably just like a year or two later. But at the same time, I think another director doing a Michelle Pfeiffer Catwoman movie would have also been a disappointment. But I think you just need the right filmmaker and the right project to bring that character to the screen.
I think so. Like, it's my favorite comic book character, Catwoman. And a big part of that is because of Michelle Pfeiffer's performance. I think, like, her vulnerability, her strength, her relatability, her transformation, the spontaneity and energy. Like, I love all of that. I think, you know, that was sort of the era before people took comic book movies seriously enough to give, like, awards recognition. But I don't know. I think it's at least comparable to what somebody like Heath Ledger's doing with the Joker.
I loved how her character is really feminist.
Yes.
I never realized it until, like, the older I got and the more I watched it, I'm like, you know, I can really appreciate it. This Selena Kyle, she's, what, run down. She's just a regular secretary, but she's in a man's world. And then she gets killed and somehow resurrects, and she becomes this femme fatale. And I really love that because she kind of owns her power. She owns her sexuality. She owns everything that she brings to the table. That's what makes this character really amazing, at least as a woman to watch. You know, as she may have a complicated backstory, but I like her complexity, and I like that fierceness that she brought to the role.
I mean, you mentioned earlier the fascist kind of imagery in the city, and I think, like, part of that is her character's oppressed, and the city's part of that. Like, it's an oppressive environment, and you feel like she's oppressed by her job and her boss and the men in her life, and she's oppressed by, like, partly it's also not just feminist, but also there's like a class aspect to her where, like, she's not rich like Batman is or Max Schreck is, or, you know, even Penguin finds out that he's heir to this wealthy family, and she's not. You see her apartment, and, like, I love the juxtaposition when Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle have to both run off and get into costume. And you see the montage where Batman's putting on his gear and he has this fancy bat cave and all these outfits. And, like, Michelle Pfeiffer's getting into her Catwoman costume in a car. She's digging her mask out of her purse, driving, like, you know, the way you'd rush to work and try to get ready when you're, you know, she doesn't have any of the things he has. It's, you know, so I think, like, there's the feminist aspect. There's also the class aspect. And I think it's just dealing with this character who's kind of lashing out at this oppression in her life. You know?
Yeah. Like, even just the bit about her playing her answer machine messages over and over again. Like, in another movie that could be a cliche, but the fact that it's people or even automated messages telling her, you're not good enough. Why aren't you rich? Why aren't you beautiful? Why aren't you successful? And then she basically, like, destroys her own apartment, and the neon sign that says hello there has been turned into hell here. It's such, like, she's like turned her whole existence inside out to show the world the angry, hungry for vengeance creature that it's manifested. And I think, you know, we immediately sympathize for her and think, you know, hell yeah, get those sons of bitches.
I also noticed like her room was filled with like stuffed animals, this very childlike type of girlish room. And then by the time she turns into the Catwoman, you see that what John was talking about, the neon sign. And I kind of took it as like kind of going from a girl to a woman. Like she's really just like transforming physically into becoming her own. I find the whole scene like pretty powerful.
Yes.
I have to admit.
Yeah, and it's, you know, her getting pushed out the window. When she says at the end, when she's trying to kill Max Schreck, like, you know, people like him don't go to jail. She's the victim of that sort of, you know, societal norm of these rich, powerful men getting away with everything because they killed her.
Yeah.
Like it was an afterthought because it was more convenient than just having her fired and being out in the world. Like pushing her out the window was easier for them than cleaning up after themselves after they've had a cup of coffee.
Yeah. So I don't know, like, you know, the idea of doing a Catwoman movie after and trying to make it like campy and silly and.
Well, maybe now, you know, we're in a post-Joker comic book movie world where maybe a daring, like, serious take on Catwoman is possible now.
And a lot of the things that are surrounding Catwoman are quite relevant, so probably someone can make one. And
you sort of mentioned, like, living in the post-Joker world now where, like, these performances can get awards, and it's sort of a little bit prestige-y, actually, to play some of these comic book characters. And I was curious what you think of the performances in these Tim Burton Batman films and how they compare to, like, maybe some of the other takes you've seen on these characters. Probably the Joker is maybe the one that stands out because you've had Heath Ledger and now Joaquin Phoenix kind of get lauded. I guess Jared Leto fits in there somewhere too. But
I guess I think the Jack Nicholson's Joker is okay. I just think he's doing Jack quite a bit, and so it doesn't come off as very believable to me. I think part of my suspension of disbelief is when he's, you know, dancing around to Prince songs, which are written for the movie. And so that takes a little bit of the menace away from this, you know, supposedly psychopathic mob hitman. And so I'm thankful that have had other interpretations of the Joker since then. And I think a lot more rounded and more interesting villains. And I think, you know, Penguin and Catwoman are more effective movie villains in any case.
I still enjoyed seeing Jack Nicholson as the Joker.
Yeah.
I think just because he was like kind of like a template for the Jokers after him. Mm-hmm. And I only noticed that it was only psychologically as the years have gone on, the character has gotten darker as we begin to explore more themes and how he becomes this mm-hmm. anarchist, you know. And for Tim Burton, yeah, he utilized Jack Nicholson's charisma and he just let him go to town. And I think that's fine because, like, yeah. Like I said, they still wanted to keep some of the comedic elements, and I think it fared off really well for this movie at that time. Nowadays, we are able to kind of expand and go a little bit deeper. Heath Ledger, of course, I'm not going to say I don't want to say it's better. It's just different because we're in a different era right now. So he was able to kind of get away and just go darker and deeper with this character to show how a complete psychopath really is. And then you have Joaquin Phoenix and Joker, and as controversial as that movie is, they were daring enough to kind of give him a story where you're borderline sympathetic, but not completely because this man is still evil. And, you know, I just see like the story being played around with the characters. It's just, they're just changing a few things, but still giving the actor enough room to experiment and give their own take. So I don't see them all as either better. They're just different because the times are now different.
Mm-hmm. Because the Nolan films take themselves so seriously, I think a character like the Joker just doesn't stand up to a lot of thought or logic. And because they take themselves so seriously, you kind of have to look at these characters logically. You know, the Joker loves to be this agent of chaos, this symbol of anarchy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then he's like employing dozens of henchmen presumably paying them somehow. He's planting explosives all throughout Gotham City and taking boatloads of people hostage. Like, all this stuff requires a lot of organization and planning, but he's also an agent of chaos. And that those two things don't track. Whereas at least in Batman 89, it's Jack Nicholson's Joker. Like, enjoy it, you know.
Jack is dead, my friend. You can call me Joker.
You sort of touched on something that, like, for me, it's one of the big issues with the Nolan films is they try so hard to kind of ground comic book logic in real life logic that it puts so much effort into explaining, like, how Batman puts his suit together and how, you know, this and that all comes together in a sort of real world way, that when you get stuff like Liam Neeson with a total comic book plan to evaporate the water of the city or something like that, it's silly. Or, you know, like a lot of elements don't land, I think, when it gets into the comic bookier stuff, which it does over the course of the Nolan films. But I think the Joker is the one element that I think really works well in the Dark Knight film. I think, like, the Two-Face stuff is really, it gets, like, really silly in that movie. But and I think a big part of it is the Heath Ledger's performance and just sort of letting that character have mystery. Like, one of my favorite things about the way that Joker's handled in the Nolan film is giving those contradictory backstories and actually letting him, you know, it's very dark, but, like, the character is charismatic and fun and interesting, you know. And Joker as a character, I think, like, Batman going all the way back into the comic books, is such a self-serious character that the Joker works really best as a foil, this character who doesn't take anything seriously and is very anarchic and it's a perfect kind of foil to the self-serious Batman character, which is why I think, like, I'm not really interested when they do a Joker solo movie like Joaquin Phoenix. It's like, I don't really care why Joker is the Joker.
Yeah, I think I totally agree that one of the things that I love about the Dark Knight is the fact that the Joker is allowed to be a liar and there's no, like, big neon sign pointed to the audience. He's lying right now. No, you can. The audience is smart enough to figure out that he's a liar. But I do love in the Mask of the Phantasm animated film from 93, where the Joker, you know, like Jack Napier, was a gangster in his former life, and he had a role in creating the Phantasm from the movie's title, but not Batman himself. So you do get the synchronicity between Batman's youth and his emergence as Batman, but it's through this other character that's also linked with Batman. So it, and in some ways it's like the best of both worlds.
Mask of the Phantasm, so good. That, like, you know, you could rank all the live action Batman movies, and I like the Tim Burton's Batman Returns best, but, like, really the animated ones, like the TV show and the Mask of the Phantasm, it's kind of in a league of its own.
Really, like, yeah, I agree.
You know, if you're talking about, like, great, great Batman and Joker performances, really it's Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill as the Joker. Like, that's kind of the definitive, or as close as you can have to having a definitive take on those characters. I think also, you know, when you do an animated series, it obviously takes certain cues from the Tim Burton films. Like, you have the Art Deco and some of the expressionist influence in there, but it kind of melds it. But, like, when you're working in animation, it kind of lets you get away with creating your own reality in a much easier way. That, like, I think Tim Burton, because he has that animation background and doing shorts like Vincent and Frankenweenie before he transitioned more into feature filmmaking, live action filmmaking, he has that skill and ability to make something feel like a live action cartoon. And so, you know, you see these concept sketches that he had made for some of the characters, and it really comes through. They have that Tim Burton personality just through the design work and, you know, through the strangeness of the world that was created. But, you know, the animation, you can kind of have that very, very easily just by this is the rules of the world. And I think, like, it's funny, like, sometimes the animated series or the animated movies, like, they have more psychological depth and relatability than, like, some of the live action versions. Like, my favorite Batman story, it's on the animated series, it's the appointment at Crime Alley, where I know some people talk about, like, Batman, there's, like, an inherently fascistic quality to the character sometimes, of this rich guy putting on an outfit to go up and beat up criminals who are poor and broke. But like, if you ever see the appointment at Crime Alley, like it's the version of Batman who, you know, I can't be late to the community center meeting, and trying to help his environment and trying to help. You know, if there's a subtitle to that episode, it might as well be like Batman versus Gentrification, where he's trying to actually help the neighborhood where his parents got shot in, and actually trying to do something to help. And I think, like, as much as Batman's a character that is often defined by his being in opposition to villains, like it's maybe a character that works best when he's actually trying to help people and save people.
Yeah, there's even an episode where it's a riff on Cool Hand Luke, where he's on a chain gang and he helps a bunch of prisoners destroy this brutal prison guard. So that is something that I think the best Batman writers are cognizant of, that there could be this very fascistic element to the character and this sort of like way that some readers might like to live vicariously in a sort of death wish or Punisher way by, you know, this guy beating up on a mugger or something. But I think you really need to have Bruce Wayne be aware of his role as the most privileged person in Gotham and do good for the systemic health of his city.
I think that's it exactly. And Keaton's performance too, like there's a gentleness and a sympathy that I think comes through in this performance that not every actor who has played Batman has. Like, you have sort of the angry Batman. You look at a film like Batman vs. Superman, which, honestly, I probably like that more than most people, but you have a scene that's a little bit infamous now where Batman finds out that Superman's mother has the same name as his mother and she's in danger, and he just drops any kind of aggression he has towards Superman. And, like, I think conceptually that's a beautiful idea for a scene, but when I saw it in the theater, people laughed like out loud at that scene. I think, like, partly in the execution, like I can't put all of that on just Ben Affleck's performance, why that scene doesn't work, but you know, you get people like almost laughing at this idea that Batman could be compassionate at that moment, even though, like, if you think about the character, it's something that should make sense and should actually be kind of a beautiful moment. But I think it has to do with how the take on the character functions, you know, because there's not necessarily a correct way to do Batman. There's obviously a lot of takes, whether it's Frank Miller or the Silver Age kind of goofy Batman stuff, or, you know, whatever version kind of speaks to you. So I think one thing I really do love about the Tim Burton films is they're not trying to necessarily be the definitive Batman. They're trying to be just Tim Burton's Batman.
Yeah,
you know? I agree. No, I've noticed that, like, just between Tim Burton's Batman and the Christopher Nolan films, Christopher Nolan does try way too hard. Tim Burton doesn't really have to try hard, because, like, right. I said, like, he knows what it's like to be the outsider, so he easily or really relates to them. I think that was easy for him to kind of translate those themes from Batman and put them on screen.
Yeah, I think one telling moment from the behind the scenes stuff that Martin, you shared with us, was Jack Nicholson, you know, the coolest customer in the history of Hollywood, saying that he was amazed how calm and collected Tim Burton was on the set of the first Batman movie. That, you know, he was this guy in his, you know, mid to late 20s in charge of the biggest movie of all time. And for him, it was just like another day at the office. So I thought that was really telling about the sort of perspective Tim Burton had about this movie.
With Batman, he really sort of cemented himself as somebody who could make interesting work on that scale, that, like, enormous mega blockbuster scale. And then, you know, watching Batman Returns, there's also this, like, anti-corporate theme that's going along, and even anti-merchandise, which it's unusual for, you know, a superhero summer blockbuster release. And I always thought, like, the Max Schreck company logo looks like a little bit of a riff on the Disney logo, and
it looks like a demented mouse. Yes. You know, it does. And it kind of, when I step back and you think about it, it's kind of like, not really like an exact middle finger to Disney, because he's working with Warner Brothers and they made this commercialized film, but he has proven himself that he can handle, you know, a pretty big budget film.
I just think, working for the company that gave birth to Bugs Bunny, I think they're all for giving the middle finger to Mickey Mouse.
That's a good point. No, I'm just saying, like, just at that point in his career, it was the boost that he needed. Because he was already kind of rejected by other studios. And at first, he was rejected by Disney. Even though he worked for them for a time, they never appreciated his style. But Batman gave him the confidence to say, now you're going to like my style. Disney was already kind of flip-flopping with Nightmare Before Christmas. They almost didn't want to sell it because they thought it would be too frightening for kids. And then he comes out with Batman. He was able to reach an audience, a larger audience than they ever anticipated. Now they want to come back and distribute The Night Before Christmas. So I just find it really interesting, like, at that time and in relation with the Batman movie, he's kind of going against different corporations regarding his style, and then he solidifies his stance as a film director.
I mean, even at the time doing Batman Returns, that was strange for him to even do a sequel. Like, he wasn't sure initially. I think it was just that they offered him that kind of complete creative control that got him back in. So, you know, he wasn't somebody who wanted to necessarily repeat himself. And I think even some of the touches in Batman Returns feel like, we did this already. How do I make it interesting? Like, the fact that it's set during Christmas, I really like. And it's like, okay, you've seen Gotham City already. Let's make it just visually different by adding the snow and changing up the environment and doing things like that to kind of make it interesting for himself, it seemed like. And it's interesting that they would pick Tim Burton to direct Batman in the first place, because he wasn't that established yet. You know, Beetlejuice was a hit, but, like, he's maybe not at that time somebody who would have been an obvious choice to helm this big blockbuster. I think it shows foresight on the part of the producers and the studio to go with him as the director. John Peters and Peter Guber, they're sort of interesting pair of producers. Like, John Peters, have either of you heard the Kevin Smith story about working on the script for the Superman movie that Tim Burton was going
to
make?
He's like, I got some directives for you if you're going to move forward on the process. Some things I want you to do and don't in the script. He's going, three things. Okay, I said, all right. He's going, one, I don't want to see him in that suit. Two, I don't want to see him fly. And three, he's got to fight a giant spider in the third act.
That's John Peters he's talking about, who wanted the giant spider, who ended up getting it in Wild Wild West. And John Peters seems like kind of a strange guy. And I think, like, some of the ideas in the Batman 89 film that seem kind of incongruous might have come from the producers and maybe John Peters. Like, the fact that Joker goes up the church tower at the very end for no reason. And, like, supposedly Jack Nicholson asked Tim Burton, like, oh, why is Joker doing this? And Tim Burton had to be like, we'll figure it out when we get to the top. I sort of suspect was maybe John Peters. Apparently he had just seen Phantom of the Opera and was like, put that in. And I know he likes King Kong, so I think, like, the whole Joker taking the woman to the top of the building before falling to his death is, like, very King Kong. So I kind of suspect that might have come more from John Peters than from Tim Burton. But for the Batman Returns, it's a different producer. It's Denise DeNovi, who did Edward Scissorhands, and she would also do Ed Wood, and she was, like, a producer who maybe worked a little bit better with Tim Burton and backed his vision. And she also did some of the films like Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach that Tim Burton didn't direct, but, like, have his stamp on them, you know? So I think, like, she just got his style and kind of enabled it with the Batman Returns.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a filmmaker, but it seems like to me one of the jobs of the producer is to protect the director from the studio, especially in a movie like this. So if you're a producer telling your director to add a set piece at the climax of your movie, that's not your job. That's the opposite of your job. So I'm glad they got a different producer for Batman Returns.
But also, I noticed that Tim Burton, he was the producer for Batman Forever. I did notice that. And there, actually, you can still see some of the signature in Batman Forever. There's little glimpses from those movies in Batman Forever. And I think that's why I kind of enjoy it so much. Like, they didn't really forget Tim Burton was part of that.
Like, Batman Forever's still trying to fit in a little bit with the series. Like, obviously, like, it's a very different approach. But, like, there are little connections that, like, yeah, we're still trying to kind of be connected to the Tim Burton ones in some way. I think, you know, even though Tim Burton didn't get to make his version of a Batman 3, some of those ideas, again, filtered into the final film, like the idea of having Two-Face as the villain and introducing Robin and, you know, like, they changed up the cast. I think, Two-Face, of course, was going to be Billy Dee Williams. And I think Tim Burton had cast Marlon Wayans as Robin, which
he was supposed to be like a garage mechanic, and they originally had Marlon Brando in mind, and then they scrapped it, and that's why he never appeared.
Yeah. And then the Batman Forever, like, it feels like, well, I think maybe people forget now because, like, there's a lot of negativity directed at the Joel Schumacher films, but Batman Forever was, like, a big hit. I think it was a bigger hit than Batman Returns, so the studio was kind of like, oh, this is clearly the direction we should go in. And I think Batman and Robin, like, Schumacher had even more control over that, and it feels even more removed from the Tim Burton stuff.
I think also critics were ready to take down comic book movies by that point, because that was, like, the end of the first wave, and they were just sort of tired of seeing big budget movies adapted from comic books. But, you know, little did we know 10 years later, that's all there would be.
Like, I think a lot of the comic book movies that came out immediately after Batman, it's sort of funny, like, they were trying to fit into that retro 30s, 40s sort of feel. You had movies like Dick Tracy, The Phantom, The Shadow, The Rocketeer. You know, they're all kind of going for that retro feel to them, and they had sort of a similar heightened stylized quality, and that kind of peaked, like you said, with Batman and Robin. And then I think the year after was Blade, which is like a comic book movie that, oh, we can do this kind of set in the real world a little bit. It's still obviously stylish, and but it has a very kind of serious, different feel to it. And then a couple years later was the first X-Men movie, which was also trying to, you know, to some extent bring the superhero more into the real world. And like, I think Blade coming up that year after kind of started off that next wave, which we're kind of still riding to some degree. Like, comic book movies used to be not necessarily like a sure hit, and there's like a lot of kind of weird culty comic book movies from the Batman era or a little bit after that, you know, like Tank Girl.
And you can see in the first X-Men movie that they didn't quite know how to handle the material, because when Wolverine first puts on his leather outfit, he makes a comment about it, and then Cyclops says, well, what did you expect, yellow spandex? Which is a reference to his costume, which is like, haha, your comic book stuff looks stupid, which is a weird line to put in an adaptation of the very material you're making fun of.
I was wondering if that was a Joss Whedon line. Like, I know he did a punch-up on that script, and that one line always kind of stands out to me. So, yeah. I know he wrote the infamous Halle Berry line about, you know, what happens to a toad when it gets hit by lightning.
The same thing that happens to everything else.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I that's probably like my favorite X-Men movie, but some of the stuff in it doesn't hold up that well. It's also funny that first X-Men movie too, like how much of a special effects showcase it was. We're now like special effects, they're just so accepted that you don't need to show them off anymore. It's just like part of the background almost, like you don't even think about it. But like showing close-ups of the Wolverine's claw coming out, or Storm, the lightning bolt through the ceiling. It was like, wow, you know, each special effect was like a little show-off, or Mystique transforming. Like, that was the selling point for the film, was still special effects. Now, nobody says, like, I'm going to go and see this film, I heard it's got really good special effects, even if they all do, you know.
That was one of the things that was sort of a joy revisiting these movies, because in the opening of the first Batman movie, I'm like, a matte painting in a superhero movie.
I love the miniatures. Like, there's so much miniature work, and you almost feel like, you know, it's a little bit similar to Beetlejuice or Edward Scissorhands, where you almost feel like the characters themselves aren't miniatures in this world. Like, they just fit into this weird perspective where everything's oversized and undersized. But, like, the opening sequence of Batman Returns, it almost didn't even register until I was, like, watching the behind the scenes, that sequence of the basket with Penguin going through the sewers, it's all miniatures. And the model, who's not just a model, she's also an actress, falls to her death, you know, like she's falling against the miniaturized background, and all sorts of really like interesting and strange kind of special effects work that kind of came from that pre-digital era. There's a little bit of digital effects, like in the Batman Returns, I think some of the bats are digital, and I think maybe there's like some digital replication to make the Penguin army bigger and stuff like that, but for the most part it's got these really charming practical effects and optical effects and stuff like that. I was wondering what you think about the Christmas theme in Batman Returns, and like that feels like very Tim Burton-y when you think of Edward Scissorhands and Nightmare Before Christmas.
It does, because I just noticed like he uses Christmas a lot in his films, or at least a wintry scene. And the only thing I really can think about it, I said it was very an interesting backdrop, because Christmas is a time of year when people feel either feel really joyful around this time of year, or they feel very isolated and alone and sad that time of year. And in the Batman Returns, you have Bruce Wayne. He's no longer with Vicki Vale. He's by himself, except for Alfred. Of course, he's always going to be there.
Sure.
And, you know, and then you have the Penguin, who is trying to find his parents. It's like Tim Burton likes to take those things of isolation and kind of keep them going. It's like it's a perfect time for him to kind of explore those things even more. And I'll say in that way, it does kind of fit in Batman Returns. At first, I gotta admit, I was kind of irritated by it. And I'm like, again, Tim Burton, why? like, you already did The Nightmare Before Christmas. You can't let this go. And it's like, no. And that, it's just, it does work at the end when Selina Kyle, you know, she, Bruce Wayne doesn't know that she survived. Okay. But it's winter. He's going home and he sees like her silhouette and sees like almost like a cat-like figure. He thinks it's her, but it's not. Then he ends up finding out the cat and he takes it back home. And you kind of bring that back around to the old Christmas idea of family and being surrounded by family. He kind of like adopts a new cat into his home. But at the same time, he is wondering, or he thinks that Selina Kyle is actually dead.
Alexandra, you hit on the exact thing I was gonna bring up. I'm sorry. Were you finished?
I just find it interesting. Like he still plays on those themes surrounding Christmas, how it can be a depressing time of year, and he kind of brings those themes back for Batman Returns. And I thought it did end up fitting the film and the characters.
And what you said about adopting a family, like I think that's a theme that runs all throughout, especially this era of Tim Burton's career, because you know, like Pee Wee. He's somebody who with no family, but he finds family on his road trip. In Beetlejuice, Winona Ryder's character, her birth family is rather problematic, and so she finds a new family through these, you know, the dead Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis. In Nightmare Before Christmas, Sally, she has to sort of reject her father/creator to find a family with Jack Skellington. Edward Scissorhands, obviously, his father dies. He finds a new family with Winona Ryder and her family. And Bruce Wayne is sort of the, you know, ultimate of found family characters, because his origin is with the murder of his parents, but he goes on to adopt Dick Grayson. He finds father figures in Alfred and Jim Gordon and Lucius Fox. And Batgirl and Catwoman are part of the Bat family as well. So I think those themes helped with the Christmas season, which is, you know, all about family and togetherness. So I think these two films thematically fit right in with Tim Burton's filmography.
Right. He's always explored that you could be born to a family, but you go also create your own. And Burton does that the same with Batman Returns. And it fit. It really fit. Yeah.
It speaks to that outsiderness where, like you said, it's the time of year when families get together and people think about being together. And if you're not, and you're an outsider and you're alone, it's very hard and it's depressing and lonely. And that's kind of the note the film ends on.
It also ends with like a slight glimmer of hope.
Yeah.
Because like with Selina Kyle, she's looking up at the bat signal and the signal's looking back at her. You kind of help but wonder, will they reunite? It was like a perfect setup for a possible sequel, but we did not get that. But you can still tie that into like the idea of family. He wants someone to love. He's lost Vicki Vale, and he kind of met someone in Selina Kyle. So you kind of wonder, will they meet up again?
Yeah. I always wonder what a third Tim Burton Batman movie would have been, or if he had done the Catwoman spinoff. But at the same time, it's like, if we had gotten that instead of Ed Wood or something like that, I would rather have Ed Wood, you know?
Yeah.
And, have you seen the documentary about his Superman film that fell apart? The Superman Lives with Nicolas Cage?
I've heard of it.
Yeah.
The only thing they described in that documentary that I thought, like, oh, this actually probably could have been really good, like this idea of Superman also as an outsider and an alien and feeling alienated. And they described this scene that they would have had where Nick Cage as Superman goes on a date with Lois Lane, and he's so nervous, like his foot's shaking and it's vibrating the whole place because he's nervous to go on this date, and he has to go outside and fly around the city and fly around the buildings just to calm himself down. And it, you know, the idea of Superman as an outsider, and maybe he can do all these amazing things, but he's not, like at the end of the day, he's still awkward and nervous and doesn't quite fit in with society. It's like, oh, like, you know, that's a really interesting take on Superman that I haven't really seen. And maybe there was enough of a nugget there to make a film out of, but it kind of seemed like, ah, it kind of got overfilled with too many half-baked ideas and didn't really come together. And, you know, maybe giant spiders. I don't know.
I think Tim Burton's imagination is just too big. You know, like, he did what he could with the Batman franchise. It ended on the right way it needed to be. He made his own personal Batman movie, Batman Returns, in his own style. Because it was in one of the videos that you gave us, one of the producers, she said, Tim Burton's mind is so vast. You know, he has so many ideas. He doesn't need the Batman franchise, you know, to utilize them. Like, he could just go and create his own world. That's how great he is. So it's okay that he hasn't made a sequel. He doesn't want to be part of making one. He did what he could. He did what he did. He's proud of what he's done, despite some of the backlash he received for Batman Returns. Because there's some people that still believe, like, they think it's too dark. And he actually is quoted saying he thinks it's less dark. There's so many conflictions regarding his style. It's like he's a man in his own little lane. And that's okay. It's like, just let him make his own work in his own little nightmarish, ghoulish, playful way. And we'll just appreciate the Batman films that he created. I mean, he's done significantly well. And it's his first Batman film that many superhero films still want to recreate.
Mm-hmm. And I think now that you've had a whole generation kind of grow up since it came out, there's people who are nostalgic for it. And there's been like some rumblings. I don't know if it's a sure thing or not of Michael Keaton maybe coming back and playing Batman again in something. But like, it's almost... like, on one hand, yeah, that'd be cool to see, but I'm not sure if it would be the same without the Tim Burton's presence. You know, I'm guessing it might be like a fun cameo or something like that if he shows up in, I think they said maybe the Flash movie or some other superhero movies kind of playing Batman again. But it's like, I don't know, like, as much as I'd like to see Michael Keaton play Batman again, somebody sort of pointed out, like, these things usually sound like a good idea until you see
it's like it. the new Star Wars trilogy already kind of gave us an idea of what we kind of wanted with Michael Keaton. It's like, it's okay. We're
fine. They bring Luke Skywalker back and it's like, oh, maybe they shouldn't have done that. You know, so.
And I think something like that score by Danny Elfman is just so iconic and so perfect that you would either have a Michael Keaton Batman without it, or you would be using it self-consciously to sort of like try and trigger our Pavlovian response to it.
It'll probably be that. They'll go all in on the nostalgia exploitation.
Yeah. Where like when I first saw Jurassic World and they used the Jurassic Park theme when like the characters first enter like the gift shop of the park. It's like, wait, you didn't earn this moment at all. Yeah, so I would be very afraid that they would try to do the same thing and it would just fall very flat. And the last thing I want is for that score to fall flat on me.
Thank you for coming on. I really had a great time and I'm glad I could have both of you on the show. So I was wondering if folks want to find you online, where can they look? Want to go first, John?
Sure. I am at Quasar Sniffer at both Instagram and Twitter. You can find the comic book store I work at on Facebook or at comicsconnection.com. I just did a Film 89 podcast about, hey, Batman Mask of the Phantasm and Into the Spider-Verse. And I'm going to be doing an Elio Petri podcast here pretty soon for Movies from Hell. And one last thing, holy crap, Martin, everyone who's listening should read Martin Kessler's piece for The Pink Smoke on Argentinian film, because that is one of the best pieces of film writing I've ever read, full stop.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, someone should give you a PhD for that one.
Thank you for that. And Alexandria, if folks want to find you online, where can they look?
Yeah, you can find me at Film and Vinyl on Twitter and on Instagram, and my website where you can find my writing is on alexandra-daniels.com. And as for project wise, I got one podcast appearance coming up real soon for the Criterion Channel surfing podcast. And I have some writing already in the draft section. So I already have a few stuff in the works already. So anything new and published will be on my Twitter page.
Awesome. And if folks want to follow me, I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. The show's website, of course, is flixwise.com. And I don't know, be sure to tune in next episode, listeners. Same bat time, same bat channel. Take care.
Christmas, Mr. Way.
Merry Christmas, Albert.
Goodwill toward men.